Case number 29790, State v. Walsh. Arguing for the petitioner, Peter Hanano. Arguing for the respondent, Craig Jerome. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Hanano, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
That's correct.
All right. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, other justices, and defense counsel. Today we're here to review a decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals in State of Hawaii versus Timothy Walsh. Basically, in that decision, the ICA overturned the lower court's ruling for assault, not ruling, but judgment and sentence for assault in the second degree, whereby the a jury found the defendant guilty of recklessly causing substantial bodily injury to the victim, Kapena Kramer. The issue today is whether or not the ICA gravely erred when it found plain error in the prosecutor's closing argument, which related to the mentioning and inference of the defendant's tailoring of his testimony because he was present throughout the proceedings. The primary case on that issue was issued by this court less than a year ago, March of 2010, that's State versus Mattson. In that decision, this court acknowledged that the DPA in that case clearly drew attention to Mattson's presence throughout the trial when she argued that, quote, he had a chance to sit through the evidence, and later he sat through the evidence, and that he had to make his story jive with what you've heard. And that was the specific finding by the Mattson court. In addition to that, this court also acknowledged that the DPA in that case referred specifically to evidence that was adduced at trial and which directly controverted Mattson's testimony. There was an immediate objection by the defense to the comments that were made by the prosecutor, and ultimately the Mattson court found that there's no violation of the State of Hawaii Constitution. This case, State of Hawaii versus Walsh, there are similarities and differences between Mattson. The differences are that in Mattson, there was an immediate objection, and therefore it was not a plain error case. This case is a plain error case. There was no objection by defense counsel when the statements were made by the deputy prosecutor in closing arguments, unlike in Mattson where there was one. Secondly, Mattson went one step further in that the deputy prosecutor in that case expressly made statements accusing the defendant of tailoring his testimony. Again, that was the comment about making his story jibe with what the evidence was shown in court.
Mr. Nano, if I might interrupt you, now that we're talking about exactly what was said in that, let me just read what was said by the prosecution. And I won't read the whole quote, but he's benefited, he being the defendant, from seeing all these witnesses. Before he got up on that stand, he saw each and every one of the witnesses, heard what they were going to say. Now, isn't that a generic accusation under the Mattson case?
Well, it is. It's not an express statement like in the Mattson case where the deputy prosecutor came out right out and said, you know, he made his story jive. That's, as the ICA noted, I think, an inference that, you know, there's an accusation that he made a story jive.
And
I would agree with the ICA in that respect.
Sorry to interrupt. Wouldn't that be a reasonable inference for the jury to make?
Whether or not
that the defendant was tailoring his testimony because of what he saw and what he heard in the courtroom?
Well, I think that goes to the ultimate question of whether or not there's a reasonable likelihood that a jury based their verdict, or there's a likelihood that those statements contributed to the conviction. I think that's the ultimate question in this case.
Can you point to anything in the record that the prosecutor said following up on this generic accusation that connected up his allegation or his inference that the defendant had tailored his testimony? I didn't find anything in the record.
Well, like I mentioned in my petition, the deputy prosecutor, after making those statements, immediately went into the testimony that came out through the state's witnesses and argued that the state's witnesses were credible and explained the reasons therefore. Specifically, prosecutor argued that the testimony of Capena Kramer and his brother, you know, was credible because of several reasons that were mentioned.
If I could interrupt you, my last question is, but is there anything that the prosecutor showed the defendant changed his testimony because of what he saw and what he heard in the courtroom?
I don't think there's any argument by the prosecutor to that respect, no. And I think that's why the ICA couldn't find that it was an express accusation of tailoring. Instead, you know, there was an implication of tailoring is what the ICA found.
Mr. Hanano, does our decision in Mattson require that the defendant change his testimony in order for an argument not to be a tailoring argument by the prosecutor to not be generic? In other words, is that the only condition under which a prosecutor can make a tailoring argument, or are there other circumstances in which a tailoring argument can be reasonably based on the record, such as when there's contradictory testimony
right.
that the defendant
yes,
hears?
Yes, that's correct, Chief Justice. I think in Mattson, there's no question that there was an express accusation of tailoring. However, in that case, because the deputy prosecutor immediately pointed to or argued the contradictory evidence that was part of the record, this court ultimately found that there was no violation. So to answer your question, yes, there are situations where even though the statements, I mean, there is a direct accusation of tailoring, this court has found that there's no violation of the Constitution, Hawaii Constitution.
Mr. Hanano, are you saying that the prosecutor in this case wasn't telling the jury that, in fact, that was what the defendant was doing, that he was tailoring his testimony to what he had heard before?
Well, again, it doesn't rise to the level of Mattson where there was an express argument of tailoring or accusation of tailoring. Yeah, I agree with the ICA that there appears to be an argument an argument of tailoring by implication.
Could a reasonable juror looking at this get the impression that the prosecution was arguing that because the defendant was present and heard everyone, that his story should be looked at differently from the other witnesses, and therefore his credibility was open to question?
Again, you know, that goes to the ultimate question of whether or not the alleged errors or the comments resulted in the likelihood of contributing to the conviction. And, you know, our answer to that is no. I don't think there is a reasonable likelihood that the statements contributed to the conviction.
Is that a harmless error? Just so you're being explicit, is that a harmless error
exactly.
argument? That if
exactly.
you, even if you assume this was
yes.
error, you believe it's harmless?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think the other thing, too, is there, you know, the defense counsel didn't object. You know, the court didn't notice it. So, you know, for the jury to notice it, despite having the court and the defense counsel not notice it, I think, you know, maybe there isn't a reasonable likelihood that the jury even was aware of what the deputy prosecutor was trying to say.
You can draw the opposite inference from that, though, right?
Right. But
the jury would accept what the prosecutor said because there's no objection and the court didn't say anything.
Well, but at the same time, I think the prosecutor also referred to the jury instructions wherein, you know, they were instructed specifically what to consider and what not to, and, you know, the manner in which the defendant testifies was also, I think.
Really, the jury instruction, you know, where it comes, where she's arguing about credibility? Doesn't it just cement the idea that because the defendant was there and the jury instruction says you can take into consideration the circumstances surrounding a witness's testimony, that her contention that therefore the defendant had an advantage over the other witnesses because he was there and he could therefore tailor his testimony was something they should take into consideration under the language of that instruction?
Well, I would have to respectfully disagree with that. I think that goes a little more than what the instruction actually says. I think definitely, you know, when a defendant testifies, their credibility can be tested and examined like any other witness. And basically, I think that's what the instruction is you know, instructing them to do.
Did Mattson say that?
That
they can be treated like a defendant can be treated like any other witness?
What I'm saying, generally speaking, I think the law is that when a defendant testifies, they can be, I guess, analyzed or judged as far as credibility like any other witness. That's what I'm saying.
Just one more question to follow up on that. So did the prosecutor argue to the jury that because the defendant was there throughout the trial, he benefited from that? And therefore, he benefited because he saw each and every one of the witnesses. He sat through voir dire. And so ultimately, she says, you know, he's different from Kepa and Capena, who were nervous, implying that since the defendant was there all the time, he wouldn't be nervous. And contrasting his testimony with Coop Ryder, because Coop Ryder apparently was not there, and so he didn't know about the testimony of the other witnesses. That was more than one question, but how would you respond to that?
I think, again, you know, it has to be looked in light of the entire record and also, you know, what the deputy prosecutor argued immediately after making those comments. Like in Mattson, because the deputy prosecutor specifically referred to evidence that was contradictory to the defendant's testimony, I think that's one of the main reasons why this court found that.
You know what's striking to me, sir, is that the your prosecutor used almost the same language the prosecutor used in Portuondo. In Portuondo, the prosecutor said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, unlike all the other witnesses in this case, the defendant has a benefit, and the benefit that he has, unlike all the other witnesses, is that he gets to sit here and listen to the testimony of all of the other witnesses before he testifies. Your prosecutor said, remember one thing that was asked by me to the defendant. You know, the defendant, first of all, is entitled, since he's on trial here, is entitled to hear and see all the witnesses. But that becomes the facts that he's benefited from seeing all these witnesses. So, I mean, the same argument's made. And we rejected that.
I agree on that part, Your Honor, because in Mattson, there's basically a two-part thing that was going on there. One, did the prosecutor make, you know, comments regarding the defendant's presence in the courtroom? And the second one, was there an express argument of tailoring? The portion that you read is similar to what the deputy prosecutor in this case said. However, in addition to that, in Portuondo, the prosecutor also said, that gives you a big advantage, doesn't it? You get to sit here and think what I'm going to say, how I'm going to say it, how I'm going to fit it into the evidence. That was not present in this case. And that's why the ICA basically found that it was an implied accusation of tailoring. So I think, you know, Mattson is similar to Portuondo. This case is similar to Mattson in a sense that there was argument by the prosecutor specifically relating to contradictory testimony of the defendant. And also, I think what this court should be aware of is in this case, there are two other witnesses. In Mattson, there was only one. And in the dissent in Mattson, it was noted that, you know, that's one of the things that weigh in favor of the defendant. When there's only one witness, and in Mattson it was the defendant, there is a more likelihood that it contributed to the conviction. And here we have two other witnesses who basically, well, they testified on behalf of the defendant. And so I think, you know, again, that's another factor that weighs against, you know, whether or not there was a reasonably likelihood that it contributed to the conviction. I think other factors are that, you know, like I stated in my application, is the sufficiency of the evidence. The charge in this case involved recklessly causing serious bodily injury to the victim. And again, you know, if you look at the evidence, there's no question that Walsh recklessly caused substantial bodily injury to the victim. The only question in this case is whether or not it was self-defense. And if you look at both the state's evidence and the defendant's evidence, I don't think there's any reasonable juror that could find that it was self-defense. I mean, the defendant himself and even their witnesses said that the victim was hit on the side of his face. There's no evidence that the victim was approaching. In fact, the defendant even acknowledged that the victim was not approaching him and that he hit the victim on the side of his face, and that there was no kind of threatening or you know, aggressive movements toward the defendant. So again, you know, it goes back to the sufficiency of the evidence as far as whether or not, you know, it was likely that the statements contributed to the conviction.
Counsel, could you, just coming back to the nature of the statements, Justice Duffy had read a passage, but the I guess the question is, as you look at the rest of the argument, there seems to be a discussion by the prosecutor regarding voir dire and the defendant's presence during voir dire. Is that, in your view, the same argument, a distinct argument, and what is your analysis as to whether that argument is problematic or not under Mattson?
I would have to agree with Justice Fujise's concurring opinion in State versus Walsh that that situation deals more with the manner in which the defendant testified and not so much as you know, tailoring or an accusation of tailoring. And I think, you know, like I said earlier, the jury is free to, you know, analyze the manner in which the defendant testifies and, you know, base their decision on who they're going to believe on just that, the manner in which a victim or, a witness testifies. And I think that situation was no different.
And Mr. Hanano, as a matter of fact, when the prosecutor comments on the credibility of the demeanor of Iokepa and Capena, it's in relation to the defendant sitting through voir dire, right? It's not in relation to him sitting through the trial and seeing other witnesses.
That's correct. I think the prosecutor basically was saying that, you know, he was able to look the jurors right in the eye and basically, you know, tell the story. And I think that is basically the gist of it.
Because that's what jurors said, indicated that they wanted, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, so the argument then is that that's the advantage that the defendant has, and so he's less credible than Capena and, Capa? Because they didn't sit through voir dire and didn't hear this stuff about, you know, in order to be believed, people should look you in the eye.
Well, I think that was something that one of the jurors said, or the jury said in voir dire, that I didn't have the transcript to review, but it appears that maybe some of the jurors said, or the question was asked, how can you tell if someone's lying?
Well, but that's what the prosecutor argued, whether
right.
or not.
Right.
And so the prosecutor is arguing that the defendant had an advantage because he sat through trial. And so he listened to voir dire, and from that he tailored or fashioned his testimony in such a way as to meet what, according to the prosecutor, the jurors were looking for in terms of looking somebody in the eye.
I understand what Your Honor is saying. I think it, again, you know, it wasn't an express accusation of tailoring, And as far as the voir dire part, I think it goes more to, again, the manner in which the defendant testified. Not so much the tailoring part, but more, you know, how he testified. And that's not something that you should just look at, you know, is whether or not somebody looks you in the eye. You know, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily telling you the truth.
What she said was, what's important about that is not only that he heard the voir dire in your questions, which some of you had mentioned. I believe you said, well, you know, if you look me in the eye. Okay, so he gets up here and looks each one of you in the eye. See how sincere I am? Does that mean you're sincere? Well, what about, you know, Kepa got up here and he was nervous. They were nervous. And at the end, she says, she winds up. So I think this thing is intertwined throughout her argument, page 42 of the transcript. But don't get fooled into a position where because somebody can look you in the eye, they must be telling the truth. If you know how to look somebody in the eye, you still can lie. If we look at the independent witness, John Cooprider, what axe did he have to grind? What did he tell you? So she ties it, even after she goes through the testimony and the instruction, she comes back to the fact that the defendant had an advantage because he sat through voir dire.
I don't know if it's so much that he had an advantage, more so that...
I'm saying that's what she said.
Right, but I think where he mentioned, I mean, where she mentioned about Cooprider, I don't think she necessarily was going that extra step in saying, well, because Cooprider wasn't here, then, you know, he should be, he's more believable. I don't think she's going that far. I think basically what she went into from there was that, okay, now here's an independent witness that the state has that basically testified to something that's contradictory to what the defendant and the defense witnesses testified to. So I see that my time is up. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. At that time, I'll urge this court not to find plain error in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanano. Mr. Jerome? Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome on behalf of the defendant appellant respondent in this case, Timothy A. Walsh. I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue Mr. Walsh's case today. A number of interesting things were brought up during Mr. Hanano's argument that I'd like to deal with at this time. The first issue that was sort of raised by Mr. Hanano was this idea that the court should draw a distinction between the implicit accusation of tailoring in this case versus the more explicit accusations of tailoring that were made in Mattson and I guess originally in Portuando. We've gone over the specifics of what the prosecutor said in this case, but I think it's important to point out that, you know, she says explicitly that Mr. Walsh saw each and every one of the other witnesses testify and heard what they were going to say. He did so before he testified, and he benefited from seeing all of these witnesses testify. As the ICA said, the obvious and inescapable conclusion of this line of argument is that Mr. Walsh tailored his testimony. That's the only sort of benefit that could be implied here. That's the only benefit that the jury could reach as far as what his benefits were. And additionally, under Mattson, I don't think there's any requirement that the accusation be explicit rather than implicit. The only specific reference to the word explicit I can find in Mattson is actually in Justice Acoba's dissent in that opinion, and it's in a quotation from the New Jersey case of State v. Daniels. And the language that's quoted from State v. Daniels, if you go back and look at State v. Daniels, where it says explicit accusation of tailoring, applies only to specific accusations of tailoring and not the more general, generic accusations of tailoring. The Daniels court held with regard to generic accusations, we agree with Justice Stevens that generic accusations of tailoring debase the truth-seeking function of the adversary process, violate respect to the defendant's individual dignity, and ignore the presumption of innocence that survives until a guilty verdict is returned. We simply cannot conclude that generic accusations are a legitimate means to bring about a just conviction. Therefore, pursuant to our supervisory authority, we hold that prosecutors are prohibited from making generic accusations of tailoring during summation. So that's what the Daniels court says about generic accusations of tailoring. Further, the court held when a prosecutor makes specific accusations of tailoring, we apply a different analysis. If there is evidence of tailoring beyond the fact that a defendant was simply present at the trial and heard the testimony of other witnesses, a prosecutor may comment but in a limited fashion. The prosecutor's comments must be based on the evidence in the record and the reasonable inferences drawn therefrom. Moreover, the prosecutor may not refer explicitly to the fact that the defendant was in the courtroom or that he heard the testimony of other witnesses and was thus able to tailor his testimony. That's where the word explicit comes from in Mattson, and it's the Daniels court talking about specific accusations of tailoring. And I don't think there's any real argument in this case that this is anything other than a generic accusation of tailoring. I think the prosecution tries to make that argument, but I just don't think it stands up. I think with regard to the implicit versus explicit, it may be helpful to look at another Hawaii case, which is State v. Wakisaka, which is a 2003 Hawaii Supreme Court case, 102 Hawaii 504. And Wakisaka concerns improper comment on a defendant's decision not to testify. The defendant in that case was convicted of second-degree murder, and during rebuttal argument, the prosecutor said, "Who was alone with the decedent? He was alone with her. He was there, he would know. If he doesn't tell us, we can only look to the decedent and see what her body tells us." And it's also worth noting that counsel for Wakisaka in that case did not object to those statements, and this court applied a plain error analysis.
Mr. Jerome, explain why, even if it is tailoring, why it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. Well, if we're talking about prosecutorial misconduct, we look at the nature of the conduct. We looked at whether a curative instruction was given. There's no curative instruction in this case. And we look at the weight of the evidence. In this case, the weight of the evidence is, looking at the entirety of Mr. Walsh's testimony and the entirety of the testimony of the other witnesses, there's a reasonable possibility that absent the prosecutor's improper comments, the jury's result may have been different. The jury may have believed Mr. Walsh's version of events. The prosecutor's witnesses, Mr. Cooprider, admits on the stand that he didn't see the commotion that was happening in the back of the Ocean's parking lot. He didn't see how that commotion started. There were a number of other security guards around trying to break up that commotion. But Mr. Cooprider also testifies that other than this fight or skirmish, he didn't see any other fights or skirmishes in the parking lot. And every other witness agrees that there are at least two other fights or skirmishes happening at the time of the incident. There were 10 or more Ocean security guards in the parking lot at the time of the incident. None of those other security guards testified. There was apparently some video surveillance of the parking lot or photographic surveillance of the parking lot. None of that showed any of the incident. Kapena Kramer, who's the complaining witness in this case, admitted that he was highly intoxicated and admitted that he doesn't really remember anything from the point when he's trying to break up the fight between a member of, I think it's his brother and one of Mr. Walsh's friends, and the time when he wakes up on the ground when he's injured. He doesn't see who hits him. He doesn't really have any context about when he was hit. Yakepa Kramer also admits that he's very drunk. His memory of the night is definitely hazy. And he admits that at the time his brother is struck, his back is turned, and he doesn't see who hits him. He doesn't see what precedes the blow.
Coming back to Cooprider, did Cooprider, I know you said he didn't see the commotions that preceded this, but was his testimony that immediately prior to Kapena being struck that he was watching the defendant and saw the defendant walk up to him and hit him?
That's his testimony, yes, is that he walked up. And I believe his testimony is that he says the defendant walked up calm, cool, and I believe he uses the word collective, which I think is a bit of a slip, but that's his testimony, is that the defendant walks up to Mr. Kramer and punches him in the side of the face. But if he doesn't know the context of what happened preceding that, he doesn't know if Mr. Walsh, as he testified, was attacked by a group of men, if Mr. Walsh is fleeing those men at the time, his testimony really doesn't do a whole lot to refute Mr. Walsh's allegation of the use of self-defense.
What testimony is there that Mr. Walsh was involved in a fight before Mr. Cooprider said he saw Mr. Walsh strike Kapena?
Well, there's the testimony of Stephanie Walsh and Lucy Mapson, who both say that he was being attacked by this group of men. I think Kapena and Iokepa both agree that there are fights going on in the parking lot, that the fight initially was started by a member of this bachelor party that...
When was the first time Walsh was punched?
I believe the first time Walsh testifies to being punched is... I'm not sure the sequence of events in terms of who gets hit first, but everybody agrees that, you know, Mr. Walsh is arguing with his sister in the parking lot. Somebody from the bachelor party comes up, another witness who doesn't testify at the trial comes up, starts, you know, getting involved in the argument, telling them to shut up, calling Mr. Walsh a howlie. Somebody steps in, there's a fight between that individual and one of Mr. Walsh's friends. Mr. Walsh says he tries to intervene and he gets hit by somebody. I think there were two fights going on. Yeah, there's two fights, and then there's another fight involving Iokeppa, Kramer, and I think Donald or Kala, who is one of Mr. Walsh's friends, that Capenna says he steps in and he breaks up that fight. And
Kala approaches Walsh near Walsh's car, Stephanie's car.
That's the first encounter? Yes.
And then somebody punches Walsh, right?
Yes.
And then the fight moves from there to an alleyway or a corner?
Yeah, I think there's like a corner in the parking lot where Walsh is
at that point assaulted by other people.
Yes, he says there's a number of people that assault him from this party, and he's not sure who they are. And he says that he kind of escapes from them. He's getting away from them. He stumbles, and he just kind of blindly punches and hits the first person he sees.
What does Stephanie testify to?
Stephanie's testimony is fairly consistent with Mr. Walsh's testimony. I mean, she testifies basically the same thing, that he's, you know...
He's trying to pull people off of him while he's being assaulted?
That's correct, Your Honor.
If I could just follow up on Stephanie's testimony was, and Mr. Walsh's testimony, was it that he was being approached by the defendant? By the complaining witness at that time, or came at him from the side, or
I think, I'm sorry.
What were the actual circumstances of that punch, according to Mr. Walsh and Stephanie and Lucy? Was it that someone was approaching him, the defendant was approaching him, or he came at the defendant from the side, or which of those two, or is it something else?
No, I think everyone agrees that Capenna Kramer is standing there kind of with his back or his side turned to Mr. Walsh, is not involved in the altercation, and Mr. Walsh kind of, as he's trying to get away from the melee, he hits him from the side or from behind. There's no indication that, you know, Capenna is approaching him or threatening him, but I think just in the general sort of melee that's going on, Mr. Walsh's testimony is he's hazy, he doesn't know what's going on, he kind of just punches at the first person he sees to try to get away, because at that point he doesn't know who's a threat and who's not a threat.
So at this point, Walsh has been involved in two physical fights prior.
Yes, sure. I mean, I think so. He's involved in sort of an initial punch, and then he's involved in this kind of melee in the corner where...
And did Stephanie testify he was injured?
Yes.
Visibly injured?
Yes, I think that's Stephanie's testimony.
So that testimony would contradict Cooprider's testimony that he saw no injuries on Walsh.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so after having been in two altercations within the space of how much time, you know?
I think it's minutes at this time.
Cooprider's testimony is that Walsh emerges from those two fights and he's walking calmly and, what was it, cool, calm, and
collective? Cool, calm, and collective, I think, is the term he uses. But Cooprider, to be more specific about Cooprider's testimony, I believe his testimony is that he doesn't observe any other skirmishes or fights in the parking lot, that he knows there's something going on in the corner, but there's other security guards there that are handling it, so he's kind of trying to diffuse the situation, because at this time, there's this altercation that's going on between Iokeppa Kramer, one of Mr. Walsh's friends, and Capenna is in there trying to defuse that situation.
And Walsh comes up to, I mean, excuse me, Cooprider comes up to that group, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there are three people in that group.
There's at least three people in that group. I have a feeling that there's also other people
standing
around the
parking lot. But Walsh says he sees only two people in that group. Capenna and somebody else.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly at the time where IACAPA is, because IACAPA says that kind of once the dispute ends between him and the member of Mr. Walsh's party, he turns his back and starts to walk away back to their truck, I guess. And at that point is the time when Mr. Walsh apparently hits Capenna. So it may have been that at that time IACAPA was already on his way back. IACAPA admits that he doesn't see what's going on. And I think that's what's going on. One of the things that's going on is everybody kind of admits that they've been drinking. Everybody kind of admits that their memory of the incident is a little fuzzy. So I think to try to piece together real specific details of what happened, we would need more neutral witnesses on either behalf of the state or behalf of the defense.
So why isn't this harmless error?
This isn't harmless error because I think that a self-defense case presents a specific set of circumstances where it's very difficult to win a self-defense case if the defendant doesn't testify. The defendant in a self-defense case is the only person that can testify as to his state of mind at the time of the incident, whether he felt threatened, whether the jury can infer that his use of force towards the other person was reasonable. So if you start calling into question the defendant's credibility, and that credibility, that questioning is based on his ability to tailor evidence based on his presence at trial or his ability to sort of ape what the jury wants to see in terms of credible testifying because he was present during voir dire, then it's tough to say that it wasn't harmless. It's tough to say that, you know, if the jury believes the defendant in this case, they're going to find him not guilty.
Do we decide credibility on appeal?
No, Your Honor.
So if there's an inconsistency between the testimony or between inferences you can draw from the testimony, who should be deciding that?
That should be up to the jury. I mean, that's the jury's role in this case, is to resolve those inconsistencies. And I think once they've been robbed of their opportunity to do that in a manner that's legitimate and doesn't prejudice the defendant's constitutional rights, then this court can't find that the error was harmless.
Counsel, just picking up on something you just mentioned, the comments about voir dire and the prosecutor's arguments about how Mr. Walsh conducted himself on the stand in terms of how he looked, how he looked at the jury, and contrasting that to the witnesses for the prosecution, how they appeared nervous, and then providing an explanation for that based on what was said during voir dire. Isn't that within the range of the kinds of argument that go to the credibility, demeanor in the courtroom of a witness, explaining why the witnesses appear the way they do, act the way they do, and is that not a typical, or is that, in your view, is that a permissible type of argument, or would you prohibit that type of argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's clear and everyone agrees that it's permissible for the prosecution to make comments about the defendant's demeanor and manner of testifying in court. I think where it becomes problematic is when we start suggesting or start accusing the defendant of tailoring his means of testifying or his manner or his demeanor based on what he's heard either during jury selection or during the trial. And I'm not sure that the closing argument is really so much of her saying that the reason why the state's witnesses behave or had the demeanor they had on the stand is because they weren't present during voir dire. I think that's kind of a stretch. I think what she's really doing is she's making this kind of tailoring argument, and then she's moving on to kind of try to rehabilitate her witnesses, because she can't say, oh, well, the defendant looked you in the eye, this was his demeanor, without then kind of dealing with the problems that are caused by her witnesses.
But wouldn't the jurors be able to assess the strength or weakness of the tailoring argument regarding voir dire? I mean, after all, they were there. They heard what they said. They heard what was said. They're sitting there, and their task is to assess the credibility and demeanor of the various witnesses. Why would they not be in a position to be able to properly balance what they saw, what they heard, and factor that appropriately into a credibility determination?
Well, they may be able to do that, but I think that the suggestion that the defendant is acting a certain way or behaving a certain way because he was present during the trial sort of poisons the well, because the defendant has no chance to respond to that. The defendant may be making eye contact because that's the kind of person he is. He may be making eye contact because he's being sincere.
How do we know? Is there something inherently evil or wrong if someone looks you in the eye when they talk to you? I mean, does it prove innocence or guilt? What does it go to? Do we know what Mr. Walsh was like before he came to trial? I mean, did he always look people in the eye, not look people in the eye? I'm not sure what it proves. What does it prove?
I don't know that it really proves anything. It's an argument that I think is made both ways a lot during closing argument. You know, the defendant was shifty on the stand, he didn't look you in the eye, or
so you're saying it's okay?
I think it's okay to make that argument in general, in the sort of abstract, because there may be situations where you don't want to put it out, because there may be situations where the defendant's evasive or another witness is evasive or they refuse to answer questions or they become argumentative, and you want to have the leeway to comment on that to the jury. But the thing is, in this kind of case, there's no evidence that the defendant changed his way of testifying because he heard the jury say, if he looks me in the eye, I'm going to find him more credible. And another point
of the problem is that they tie that in to his presence, right?
Absolutely. They tie that.
So what would be the difference if we find that the defendant's presence shouldn't burden him because he gets to hear the witnesses? So doesn't the same rationale apply to, because he's at trial, he gets to hear voir dire?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that if we go take a step back to Portuondo, that this is kind of the argument that Justice Scalia relies on Portuondo to say it's not impermissible. He says that we're not talking about the defendant's, we're talking about allegations that affect the defendant's credibility. And the defendant's credibility is supposed to be assessed like any other witness. So this isn't impermissible, because if any other witness was in the courtroom, the prosecutor would be able to make this argument, or the defense counsel or prosecutor would be able to make this argument about tailoring. And this court rejected that analysis in Mattson.
Well, this court also said in Mattson that by the prosecution making this argument final in summation, that it prevented the defendant from being able to respond. You recall that?
Yes, sir.
And so in this particular case, there was no opportunity, was there, for the defendant to respond?
No, Your Honor, there's no opportunity for the defendant to respond.
I don't necessarily subscribe to this, but how could the prosecution have set this up so that the defendant would have had an opportunity to respond?
I think that there's ways to do it so the defendant has an ability to respond if it's done during cross-examination, but I think that's, I don't necessarily want to say that that would be the proper, would be proper for the prosecution to do that, but at least if the prosecution asks the question during cross-examination and gives the defendant an opportunity to deny it or to explain it perhaps on recross, then the defendant at least, it's not just this sort of empty accusation that the defendant doesn't have the opportunity to respond to. So if the prosecution asks, well, I noticed that you're making eye contact with the jurors as you testify today, the defendant says yes, and the prosecutor asks, is that because you heard them say during voir dire that if you made eye contact with them, they would find you more credible? Then at least that they can see his response to that question and see, evaluate his credibility. But when it comes during closing argument, there's just...
But could not the defense attorney... this comment by the prosecutor was made in the opening closing argument of the state, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the defense attorney could well have argued in closing to the contrary. My client is a very credible person. He came in here, he told it to you straight. You could watch him, you could see him. The suggestion by the prosecution that he's somehow tailoring his testimony to what you wanted to hear in voir dire is absurd. Here's why his statement makes sense. Here's why he's a credible person. Here's things about his demeanor. All those arguments could have been made. So there was an opportunity to respond. And in fact, and is it your position that that's not an effective opportunity to respond?
I don't believe allowing the defense counsel in rebuttal to address questions related to this sort of thing or questions related to generic accusations of tailoring otherwise is an effective chance for the defendant to respond because it's defense counsel speaking on behalf of the defendant. The jury doesn't get a fair chance to evaluate the defendant's credibility as he answers the questions, to really see how he responds. And quite frankly, I think that jurors tend to not necessarily have the highest faith in defense counsel or attorneys in general as far as the arguments that we make. I think it's much more effective and much more powerful if it comes from the defendant's mouth through his testimony.
So isn't the logical implication of your argument then if the prosecutor wants to argue the defendant is shifty or looks nervous on the stand, he's going to have to say, don't you look nervous right now, Mr. Defendant? Isn't it true that you're appearing shifty right now? Because otherwise the prosecutor wouldn't be able to make that argument.
I think that that's a permissible argument in closing argument so long as it's not tied to the fact that the defendant is behaving that way because he's been present during voir dire or in any other stage of the trial.
Well, why would it make a difference whether he's nervous because he's, you know, the prosecutor's implication is you're nervous because you're not telling the truth, you're nervous because you know what you're saying is a lie, or you're nervous because or you're acting in a way, another way, because you're trying to satisfy the jurors? Why in one case would it be necessary to question the witness about that and in another case not?
Because I think that making the suggestion that the defendant is, what the suggestion is, the defendant is essentially lying. He's acting, he's behaving unnaturally because he heard somebody say, if you behave this way, I'm going to find you more credible. So the prosecutor is basically accusing the defendant of lying based on what he's heard during the trial, which is the same sort of generic accusation as far as the defendant is tailoring his testimony based on what he's heard in the trial. I don't see the distinction between whether he's lying through his words or he's lying through his actions while he's on the stand in terms of...
But it's based on something very specific in the record. It's not focusing on just the mere fact that you're present in the courtroom, it's focusing on the fact that you were present in the courtroom when this specific thing was said during the course of voir dire. Much as in Mattson, the argument was you were here in the courtroom and you heard the witnesses testify in a manner that was contradictory to your prior statement, and then you testified in a different manner. So wouldn't it be the rule of Mattson that as long as there's a specific argument based in the record, based in things that are in fact happening in the courtroom, that's not an impermissible argument? And how would that rule apply here?
Well, one of the things you mentioned about Mattson is there is a prior statement. There's something that the defendant in Mattson admits, I lied before when I made my prior statement. He admits that there is a prior statement that's inconsistent with his testimony, so the prosecutor's allowed to draw that inference out for the jury that the reason why he has to change his statement is because this witness said, and I think in Mattson, it's this witness said he had a knife, so now he's got to figure out how the fact that he had a knife fits in with his prior statement that he didn't have a knife. In this case, there's no, oh, I'm sorry.
Trial courts inform jurors that they are to rely on their decisions upon evidence introduced in the trial. Is there evidence introduced in the trial regarding jurors' comments? Should that be considered in their determination, in their verdict, matters that are not evidence, or is it evidence for them to consider?
It's not evidence, Your Honor. And one of the things is the defense or counsel during closing argument is allowed to comment on the evidence. They're allowed to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence. And I don't believe that the jurors' comments during voir dire are evidence.
Can only be convicted on the basis of evidence, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what the jurors said and whether or not the defendant in fact tailored his demeanor in order to satisfy what the jurors said in voir dire would have to be proved, wouldn't it? I mean, how can you argue that if it's not in the evidence?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's kind of the point I may have been trying to make inarticulately, is that there's nothing here to suggest that his behavior or his demeanor changed at all from what it would have been if he hadn't been present during voir dire.
But counsel, if that's true, isn't the logical implication then that you cannot argue in closing argument that the defendant was nervous, appeared shifty-eyed, appeared hesitant in his or her testimony? Because none of that is frankly in the record, right? It's all based on personal observations of the jurors in a way that, unless that question, I guess, is asked, it's not going to be in the record. So in essence, the ultimate implication of the position you have today would appear to be that there will be no argument about the demeanor of the defendant while he or she is on the stand.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's the argument. That's not what I'm trying to make.
I guess what I'm asking is, how can you draw the line between what we're talking about here and the situation I'm describing, where the prosecutor just wants to argue, look, the defendant appeared very nervous on the stand, particularly when I asked these questions. And that's not in the record. The fact that he or she was nervous, that's not going to be in the record in a way that, for example, would be apparent on appeal.
That's correct. And perhaps we have to draw the distinction between what is going to be in the record on appeal and what is evidence or what's in the record at the trial court. I think that a long line of cases, and the jury is entitled to consider the demeanor and appearance of witnesses while they're testifying. And, you know, the jury observes the witnesses testify. The jurors are reminded that, you know, the closing arguments of prosecutors are not evidence. They're to rely on their own memory of the evidence. So just because the prosecutor says he was hesitant or shifty or didn't make eye contact doesn't mean that that's really what happened. The jury has to look to their own recollection of how he appeared when he was testifying.
So why is this case different?
This case is different because the prosecution has accused Mr. Walsh of changing his demeanor based on nothing more than the fact that he exercised his constitutional right to be present during trial.
You know, in this jurisdiction, there is a case that says if you're going to talk about trial conduct of the defendant, that you have to put it in evidence if you're going to argue it in summation.
I'm not aware of that case.
State v. Smith. State v. Smith, the defendant apparently chortled. That's what the case said. And the state argued to the jury that the defendant chortled. And the ICA said, one, that's testimony by the prosecution. Number two, it's never put in evidence. Three, if you want to put it in evidence, then you have to do it during the trial. Otherwise, you can't argue it, because you can only be convicted on the basis of evidence submitted at trial. I mean, I'm not sure what the other cases say, but at least it's the law in Hawaii.
Thank you, Ron. And I guess the answer to that is that if the prosecutor wants to argue it, they can say, let the record reflect the defendant is doing X, Y, or Z on the stand, and then they can argue it during summation. I see that my time has expired. Could I briefly conclude?
If you would just take a moment to wrap up.
What I'm going to encourage this court to do is to affirm the decision of the ICA vacating Mr. Walsh's conviction. And I think the real issue here is we don't want to encourage gamesmanship and unscrupulous behavior on the part of the prosecutors. We don't want them trying to figure out ever more subtle, ever more implicit ways of suggesting that the defendant is tailoring. I think the court in this case needs to draw a clear line that this type of implicit accusation isn't acceptable in this state. So we're going to ask the court to affirm the ICA's decision.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jerome. Mr. Hanano, do you have any rebuttal?
On the last comment that was made by Mr. Jerome, there's no gamesmanship here. I mean, the Mattson decision didn't come out until after this case was upon appeal. So when the case was heard at trial, there's no Hawaii Supreme Court opinion directly on point on this issue. So it wasn't done intentionally. There's no gamesmanship done by the state in this case.
As a matter of fact, there was no objection either, right?
And again, there was no objection. And you know, talk about gamesmanship. The interesting thing is the Office of the Public Defender was the one that actually represented Mattson. So apparently they were aware of this issue and still no objection during trial. So if you want to talk about gamesmanship, I think we should take a look at that. Nevertheless, I think The main issue in this case, again, like I said earlier, is whether or not the defendant assaulted Mr. Kramer in self-defense. And I think it's clear from all of the witnesses, whether you look at Mr. Cooprider's version or defendant's sister or the defendant or defendant's sister's friend, all basically say the same thing, is that Capena Kramer was just standing there. He was not threatening or assaulting Walsh in this case, and he got basically sucker punched to the side of his face, which caused him to fall down, hit his head, and break his jaw, basically, as a result of the punch. So that's the main issue. It's not about whether or not, you know, the punch caused the broken jaw. It's about self-defense. And again, the state of mind is reckless. It's not intentional or knowingly, it's reckless. To go up to somebody who's just standing there, you don't know who they are, hit him on the side of the face. You know, it could have been the security guard, it could have been an innocent bystander. He didn't know, even know who Capena was. So the bottom line is, you know, look at all the testimony, the undisputed testimony. Was it self-defense? And I think there's overwhelming evidence to say that it wasn't. So we're going to ask that the court not find plain error in this case. Plain error, again, is to be sparingly used. And, you know, this is an adversarial system. And we still is asking that this court overturn the ICA's decision in this case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your arguments today, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.